This is Embracing Change with Lakrita Bowman and Jennifer Osborne.
Welcome back to the Embracing Change podcast. I am Jennifer Osborne here with Lakrita Bowman. You are joining us in our season called Three Minds of Incarceration. And we've been through the first mind, which included abandonment, abuse, selfish ambition, defense mechanism, control, and competition. And the last two episodes have been on the second mind, which was during incarceration, which we covered anger and resentment. And now we're going to cover control again, but how it relates to being in incarceration or during incarceration.
Yeah, you know, because the second mind being during incarceration, you still have to have a certain mindset to survive prison. You know what I mean? A true prison.
A physical prison.
A physical prison.
Yeah.
And I think that even when you look at it and you are comparing it to emotional prison, it's the same thing. And what I want to talk about a little bit, when it talks about control, it says correctional control extends beyond the number of people in the prison or the jail. For every person incarcerated, there are more than two people are being supervised by other people. This population is a major driver of the prison population, in particular the population of inmates who have committed nonviolent offenses. In other words, they're saying for every one prisoner, there are two people guarding them.
Wow.
And so when you think about that, that means that there is a sense of security and control for two for everyone. Can you imagine that?
No, I'm sitting here in my mind thinking what that would be like to have two people guarding you at any one point in time.
And that's what they're saying. They said, in other words, for every, you know, if you look, when you go, I can only share because I've been in prison many times. And for every, like, prisoner there is, I'm just going to say if there's 30 prisoners there, you can believe, I mean, just in one location there for every, so if there's two people guarding every 30, that's 60 somewhere, there's 60 people somewhere on those grounds.
Wow.
You know what I mean? Because they have to look at it from so many angles. And so.
That's including like front desk people.
Exactly.
Or desk people and.
And even, you know, guards, people who control the systems, meaning there are ways, you know, the gates, the doors, because all of them is ran by a control system.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? And keys. So when you think about that, even emotionally, when you doing incarceration, your mindset has to be, I know my mindset had to be, I had to shift my mind because there's a world inside of incarceration. It's its own world. It's its own culture,
society.
You create your own families. So somewhat incarceration creates somewhat of a lack of reality and some denial because you have to start creating these fantasy worlds or fantasy existence just to survive it. Does that make sense to what I'm saying?
Not exactly. Okay. Unless you're referring to you create your own culture, your own societal rules, your own.
That's exactly what I'm saying. So it's almost like there is societal rules in the world, like stop signs and, you know,
traffic
what I mean?
Lights.
Traffic lights. Yep. Those are societal cultural rules to keep us safe, to keep us controlled to some level. So we're
respecting
not
respecting one another,
another.
Yep.
Because naturally we won't do it on our own.
Right.
It's sad, right. But we won't.
It's true.
Because we all are such selfish, self-centered people.
Yeah.
And we want what we want, how we want it, when we want it, as much as we want.
Yep.
So we don't consider each other as much. And so when you think about in prison, you've already committed the crime. You've already broke the law. You've got your sentence. What do you have to lose at this point? What is it that you have to lose at this point? Honestly, you're already inside a controlled environment with people controlling you. What do you have to lose?
Is it so structured at any point in time that you really don't have to think about things?
You don't have to think about anything. So why, you know, the one thing, that's why I'm saying, how do you wonder how people stay incarcerated after getting out? Because nobody trained them to think on their own, because everything is controlled already. Everything is established. Everything, what you wear, what you eat, when you go to bed, what job you have, where, who's your roommate, where you're going to live, how long you're going to stay. So nobody's creating opportunity to make real choices. What programs are there? You're not having, so when you come out into society and you are free to make certain choices, do you really know how to make those choices? Or are you still being controlled by the structured environment and culture that you were set in for so long?
It makes me think of Shawshank Redemption, when the one gentleman got out of prison and he's bagging groceries and he is like, can I go to the bathroom? And the guy's like, you don't have to tell me, just go. But he was so
conditioned,
ingrained, yeah.
And conditioned and controlled that he never was able to make those decisions without permission.
Right, yep.
And so therefore, you don't, when I talk about this kind of control during incarceration, I also think about how does someone really heal from the control that they've been in. And so when you look at control from before incarceration, when you was trying to control the pain and control people and control your behaviors, you know what I mean? When you're in incarceration, everything is being controlled for you. So you're not being able, you're not being taught or realigned to make real choices. It took me a long time after incarceration, and I'm still, I would say to people, I had to learn that I had the freedom of choice. Because for so long, in and out of incarceration, I did not feel I had the freedom of choice. Because everything that I did was already pre-planned for me.
Well, and you also had the extra layer of fear, did you not? Of like, you did not want to go back to prison. You were so like, I'm going to make a change in my life. I don't know how to do it. Like
this last time.
Yeah, that's what I mean.
Yeah, but the other times I went back 4 and 5 times and 6 and 7 times was because I had no fear.
Yeah.
You know, it was the way of life. It's what I learned, you know. So being out here free, I didn't even know how to honestly adapt to this world.
Well, it's kind of what I was getting at. Like how the last time you got out, just trying to figure out, okay, I've been under this control, but I want to change. So how do I make those right decisions? How do I do those things? You were talking one time about how you had that anxiety attack going into a store. So even unconsciously, you were trying to change, but it was like...
The mindset, it was there. My mind was incarcerated.
Yeah.
It was incarcerated. And so I'm faced with, every time I go to a store, my old life was that I was committing a crime. I'm going into a store this time not wanting to commit a crime, but all I know is that's how I do. So stores related to me or connected to me was that I was going to commit a crime.
Yeah.
I wasn't ever going into a store just to be, I guess, a good person.
To shop.
Right. I was going to shop. I just wasn't going to pay for it. I was shopping.
You were shopping already.
I just wasn't going to pay for it. And I used to justify it because I felt like the prices are still so high, which they still are.
Yeah.
Because they triple, you know, they upgrade those prices on stuff. And so I used to feel like I was Robin Hood. I would steal from the rich and give to the poor.
Which was you.
Which was myself and other people, because I was selling my stuff. I would steal things, as they call it, as a booster. And that was like a business for me. And I would take orders from people. People would go to stores and find stuff they like. And then they come to me and tell me where it's at. And I go get it for them.
Wow. An entrepreneur, even back
I've always been an entrepreneur. Entrepreneurs, as I was saying, when we were talking to the children, it don't change. You know what I mean? It's in me. I'm gifted that way.
Yeah.
You know, it's a gift. Entrepreneurial skills was always a gift. God doesn't take our gifts. They're without repentance. In other words, he gave them to us when we were created in our mother's womb. And he doesn't go back out and say, oh, she's not going to use that gift right. I'm taking that back. You know what I mean? And that's what makes him so loving, is that because he is like, he hopes and prays that we do right by what he gives us, but he doesn't force us to do so. But when you have the mind of incarceration and control, it is a way of us thinking. It's a mentality that people have.
Yeah.
And so that control, not just trying to control your emotions, now you're trying to control your safety, your environment, your relationships. You know what I mean? You're trying to control how you move and you know, how you behave and how you, because you can get locked up and locked up, meaning there is a, they call it solitary or the hole, or, you know what I mean? So where you will be even isolated more from other people of the population that you are in if you do something to break the security of the prison or the rules or, you know, the principles and practices, then you can be locked up and locked in, which can be, I'm just going to say, you know, when you have someone's ability, you know, to, that is just being 23 hours in a cell, 1 hour out. I can't, you know, I didn't have that experience very often, but there were people who were on death row and that was all they had. So I can only imagine what it was like for them to be in a cell for 23 hours a day and out for recreation to take a shower and, you know, certain stuff for 1 hour every day. So you get, you know, 1 hour, so 30 hours a month out of a cell. I can't even imagine.
Sounds like torture.
It can be.
Yeah.
You know, and it can be, especially mental torture. It takes a strong mind to survive that. You know what I mean? I can only imagine the mental capacity it takes to hold yourself together and create your own world 23 hours a day. And I'm sure, you know, some hours of sleeping, but I'm just saying when you just say 16 hours of waking hours, you know, 8 hours or whatever, maybe sleeping, you know what I mean? Or off and on, but that's a long time and by yourself isolated, especially since the Bible says it is not good for man to be alone. So there's no connection to other people when you're isolated inside prison.
Which has got to be horrible.
It is. You know, it talks about, what does control movement mean? It says movement control can be defined as the ability of the nervous system to control the contraction of the muscles. But when you talk about incarceration, it says there's multiple stages of movement control, so which includes intent, planning, programming, and execution of movement. So all of these things to control this environment goes into that. And so what about us trying to, after that's happened for you for so long, then you get out and now you have to control your intent, create your planning, your programming, meaning life programming, and then not only plan it, but execute it with moving forward. Can you imagine I don't have to imagine. I've been doing it for 32 years now, getting back into who I originally was meant to be. So it's a constant planning. It's a constant execution. It's a constant movement of forward movement, not getting stuck, you know, realizing that everything, just because it feels that way or looks that way, doesn't mean it is that way. Being curious versus concrete, being open versus closed, being ability to speak a real emotion versus bottling it up inside of me and not saying anything.
Or acting out.
Or acting out in a behavior versus, you know, just expressing how I feel. So all of that that was done for me for so long during incarceration, all that control that was created for me, and I had not to think about anything, not what I was going to eat, what I was going to wear, where I was going to go, and then getting out and having to, you know, having to create all of that for myself.
Almost like breaking free of being brainwashed in a matter of speaking. Like, people get into cults, and people that have never been in cults will say, I don't understand, like, why they didn't just walk away or leave or whatever. Well, after being conditioned so long and being surrounded by a certain mindset that said, this is the right thing, this, you're in the right place, it becomes like a mind frame, a mindset. Like,
they actually got us, it's called the Stock Syndrome.
Stockholm
Syndrome. Yeah, Stockholm Syndrome. Yep. It's the same difference.
Yep, exactly. So I can only imagine that once you are freed from that, it's like relearning how to have, in like incarceration, having control of yourself again. Someone else isn't controlling you, right? And also with like being brainwashed, you're not being controlled again. You have to learn how to get a hold of yourself, create your own agency, no longer have like that prison mindset of whatever it is.
And not only that, when most people get out of prison, they also have control. It's called community control, which is a probation officer or parole officer who's also like controlling you and telling you what to do, you know, and not necessarily in a negative. That can be a positive as well, because you can look at that person as a coach. Most of people come out of prison don't look at it. That's like when I decided I wanted to be better, my first point of person was my probation officer. And my probation officer was looking at me like I was crazy when I was asking for help. Because like she said, I'm not used to people asking me for help. They usually running away from me. They're trying to run around me or manipulate me, you know what I mean, or get over on me instead of saying, hey, I really need you to help me because I want to stay out of prison.
Yeah.
She's like, usually that's not how it goes. And so for her, she had to go to her supervisor to say that this woman is coming to me, asking me to assist her to stay out of prison. And I knew she had only been a probation officer maybe 6 months. She said, and I don't know what to do. She wants to, like, she wants not to go back to jail. And she was wondering if there was a halfway house or some program she could get into. And I don't know what to do with her. And so, you know, it's amazing that now the resources for that is so overwhelming. You know, there's so many resources out there. That's one of the reasons I started this ministry, as everyone knows, is because when I came through the systems, there were no homes like this for women that would give them the opportunity and the time to teach them the life skills that they knew that they needed in order not just to survive, but to thrive, to be successful, to actually take your time, be mindful of the time you're taking, and actually applying that time to really digging deep inside yourself to unlock your incarcerated mind to whatever your life controlling issue is. Whatever your pain is, to whatever your trauma was, whatever your experiences have been. It's giving you a safe space and not looking at it as how much time it takes, but how much time do you need?
Yeah.
Which makes a difference.
And it makes me sad to think that there are people who have gotten so used to the control that incarceration provides that they will do things to go back. I mean, that happens. I'm not sure what the statistics are with regard to people that just recommit a crime or those that will commit a crime because they want to go back to someplace familiar. But I find that just very sad that someone didn't really walk with them about learning how to live again.
I know. And this is that, and that's the thing, because I just think that when you look at Leviticus in the Bible and it talks about breaking the law, you know, you look at some of the laws and how they were laid and how man has adopted some of those laws, but then they've taken their own consciousness and own ability to put those laws into space and place and create prisons. And now you're, like I said, people are privately owned prisons and
yeah.
and those kind of things. So it's a new kind of slavery. And that's what I'm saying. It's a new kind of control that you get during incarceration, the mindset during incarceration, but then learning how to unlock yourself once you get out of incarceration. The mindset that you have to shift your whole mindset. And not only your mindset, but your behaviors and your thoughts and your emotions. There's a lot that goes in. There's layers and layers and layers. They now have this thing called the four cluster of the symptoms of post-incarceration syndrome. They call it PICS. You know what I mean? It's just so amazing, you know. And then they talk about it in a way, and they says institutionalized personality traits. What's common of incarceration is a chronic state of learned helplessness in the face of prison and authorities, and antisocial defenses in dealing with an inmate culture. That's called institutionalized personality trait.
Wow. It's got a name.
Yeah. Now they're saying post-traumatic stress disorder from both pre-incarceration and trauma experienced within the institution. Then it's antisocial personality traits developed as a coping response to institutional abuse and a predatory or prisoner culture.
Wow.
Then social sensory deprivation syndrome caused by prolonged exposure to solitary confinement.
Oh, which we were just talking about.
That radically restricts a social contact and sensory stimulation. So this is all now, you know, emotion, you know, I would say the mental health, and people are coming up with these, you know, definitions to some of the stuff that people are experiencing after, you know, during incarceration. So it's, you know, that's called post. And then they have one that's actually called the five stages of incarceration. And the first one they say is just like we've heard these about grieving. So they have, it says the five stages of incarceration is denial. Incarcerated people swing from emotions of rebellion to withdrawal and find it hard to believe their reality in this system. They tend to blame their situation on others, often callous toward victims, and have trouble comprehending the seriousness of their consequences. Anger. When faced with their reality, they no longer deny the situation. An incarcerated person often becomes angry, may threat lawsuits, express grievances, or bully weaker people. Some join gangs. They may demand equal treatment, but show little regard for fairness. Bargaining. They promise to mend their ways in exchange for favors, often filled with guilt, frustration, shame. It's hard for an incarcerated person to believe God will forgive them. Depression. Incarcerated people begin to face the consequences of their action, and they grieve their loss of freedom and separation from loved ones. Acceptance. Others experience genuine soul searching and accept some responsibility for their situation. Attitudes are improving. They fall into a routine and usually try to improve through reading, school, church, or work. A sense of peace moves in, and many show a sincere desire to change. Those are the five stages of incarceration.
Which does sound very similar to grieving.
Exactly.
Yeah.
And so they now have a whole book out called Post-Incarceration Syndrome.
Which is called PICS.
Exactly. Yeah. You know what I mean? So, because I think, and I think that it's good, that information is good to have, because I think that people are starting to realize, it's something that you just said about when people are incarcerated, you know what I'm saying? Not only, you know, it's a mental thing, it's an emotional thing, it's a physical thing, and then you expect them to get out after everything has been so controlled for them. And you can't, you know, I understand the saying now more than I ever have when it says, I say it all the time, you, when you know better, you do better. I'm learning more and more that means when you have more information, you have the ability to comprehend that information, you have people around you helping you understand that information, and then people in a community that's going to help you walk out that information.
Yeah.
It's like, it's not just knowing it, it's actually creating a community of support that can help you know it, comprehend it, understand it, and move forward with it. And that takes a lot of different kind of support. And people who have that ability to know that, and I know for me, that's what I realized, I had to finally say, I don't know how to live. But if somebody is willing to teach me, I am willing to learn. So I had to forget about what I thought I knew and start dealing with the emotional trauma of my life and be willing to look at it for what it is, and then be willing to put the right people around me to help me walk through the different process.
Yeah, because you got a counselor. I remember you talking about that, and which... She was not the one who was the believer, right? That helped you come to faith, right?
No.
A different person. Okay.
Yeah, the counselor was not. She was just a person that when I was in the halfway house, they told me that I wanted counselor. I got an evaluation from her, Nancy Smith Gosselin. I got a evaluation for her from Talbert House that she was working for them. And I realized in my evaluation, though she said I was a smart person, which I am a genius. And, you know, and she was just, she didn't really see, she knew I had some trauma, but she did not recommend the next steps of counseling. It was me saying, I know I need more than just an evaluation. I need someone to help me. And then Talbert House was not willing to pay for it. So if I got counseling, you know, back then, you're talking 32 years ago, they were not offering the resources they have today. So if I wanted counseling, I had to figure a way to pay for it. Ugh. And I remember going to her and asking her, I don't have any money, but I know I need some counseling, or I need somebody to help me navigate this little girl that's running my life. And that's when she thought about it, came back to me and said that she had just started this new therapeutic piece about healing the child within, and so she would be willing to walk with me.
That's amazing, because when you've been incarcerated in it, in your mind, in a different way, as it relates to like trauma and coming out of those things, you don't recognize that you need to heal a child within. You don't recognize that your mindset is wrong. You just think, I'm just gonna keep forward. Keep walking forward and doing my thing, and I don't need all of this. And yet you recognized maybe counseling could help me. Like, you were willing to say, maybe my mindset isn't what it should be, because obviously I've not been able to change or move or grow, but I need to do something different.
And it's so amazing you would say that, because that didn't happen on my own. I now know that God was guiding that.
Yeah.
Amen. You know what I mean? I didn't even know him that way, but it goes back to the same. Though I didn't know him in the way that I do today, when he came and spoke to me and said, inside that prison, you'll never have definition of meaning till you come back to the source. So I didn't know what that meant. I just thought, you know, I had been in Longview. People hear voices. You know what I mean? I'm hearing a voice. And we talked about that in my book.
Yep.
I'm hearing this voice speak to me. And I know that one of the persons that had given us feedback on the book was saying, unless you've been saved and all that, I wasn't saved and I heard the voice. Right. And I now know that that voice was not something that I would have said to myself. Matter of fact, I thought hearing it, I was hearing voices. I thought I was having a mental health breakdown. Well, I just, back then we didn't call it mental health. I just thought I was going crazy. We called it going crazy.
I thought it would be called a nervous breakdown.
Yeah, nervous breakdown, going crazy, insane. I just, you know what I mean? I didn't know nothing about, we didn't know, that 32 years ago wasn't nothing about mental health. You know what I'm saying? It was just, you were, you know, you was mentally crazy. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
And so it wasn't about, and so for me, it was like hearing voices. So now do I know that that was the voice of God inside me? I do. And was I saved? And had I confessed him with my mouth and believed him in my heart? Maybe as a child somewhere I might have, you know what I mean? But not in a conscious way of really wanting to be in a relationship with him. But yet he was coming after me for himself.
Well, I think he knew you would be open because you heard that call. And it was different that time, right?
It was. I mean, I didn't only just hear it. I saw myself, and you talk about the healing. I saw that little girl wrapped in barbed wire. Yeah. It's in my book. I saw her.
Yeah.
So I think that that picture, that moment, all of that was a part of during my incarceration and dealing with the control that I was in and trying to come, once I was coming out of that or had that experience, I was on my way out of being incarcerated physically, but knowing mentally, emotionally, spiritually, relationally, that I was going to have to learn how not to be incarcerated.
Yeah. I think that's the difference. You wanted it. You were open. Again, going back to survivors of abuse, sometimes they never visit it and they never deal with it. So they're never completely free. And they don't let God into those areas that are pretty scary to look at. You know, like, mm-hmm. I'm sure you looking at the little girl with the barbed wire, it wasn't really easy going back to all that stuff. So it's just that difference, because I know people that have suffered abuse that are just like, Bible says you press forward, you don't look back. I'm just going to keep going. And yet there are things in their life that are so wrecked that Jesus wants to heal, that they won't let him into those spaces.
Mm-hmm.
So that's really a big, big difference. And just being willing and open.
And I think just like the five stages of, you know, of incarceration, when it talks about, you know, denial and bargaining, you know, it's all about grieving, because you got to get to the space of acceptance. Because when you can get to that space is when you're open to something different. When you stop blaming other people, trying to control other people, control yourself in ways that are unhealthy, and begin to be open to the possibility that something in your life is off. Mm. And it doesn't mean you're off, but something's off. Something's off kilter. And being able to realign your whole life to a new truth.
Yeah. It's epic.
It's epic.
Yeah. Yeah. Once you're willing to look at it for what it really is, to move forward, to be authentic, to be real, to be vulnerable, man, I think that's when God does some of his best work. But he won't force us. Like, we have to be willing to say, all right, I'm going to step in, which you were.
It's an invitation.
Exactly.
An invitation. It's not even an application. It's an invitation.
Yeah.
And you have to be willing to take on the invite.
Yeah.
It's just like being invited to a party. Nobody's making you go. They send you the invitation in the mail. You look at your calendar. You see, am I available? And even if you are or you're not, you can choose not to go or to go.
Yeah.
It's an invitation.
And isn't it sad? I don't know about you. I can only speak for me. But I will see people that I know could live a much happier life, a much more fulfilled life, if they would but let God into those spaces.
Oh, yeah.
You can't make them, of course. Everybody has a free will, but it makes me sad at times. And I know even in folks in recovery, like just seeing them at their different spots and their denial and just knowing, like, you've been there, you know how to get out of that. You want to help them, but they're like, not letting you into that.
Because I'm even, like, a couple of situations God has invited. The word that comes to me now is that this is where I'm working. Will you come? Like, I can hear the Spirit of the Lord say, Laquita, this is where I'm working. And right now he's working with me in some levels of forgiveness, deep levels of and I believe it's more now about understanding, not just it's the act, but it's more about the deep level relationship of what he did for me.
Yeah.
And that also is a space that he is saying in this. I got a word from the prophetic, and they saying that one of the things that the Lord is doing is that I have a heart like David. They gave me a word, and the word was tenderhearted. And I'm like, okay, I see God moving there. I do. I see him moving. He has given me an invitation to come over. Like, here's where I'm working. The word I gave you for the year is believe. You know, and I'm seeing so much of that word come to pass in my life, because when he first gave it to me, my thought was, I do believe. And now I see that word is so much deeper. Yeah. Because even to hold grudges or to be critical and to be judgmental comes from a place of unforgiveness. And to truly love other people, that's a space that God is showing me how he loves us. And he is showing me about what it was that he did for me so I could be forgiven.
Amen.
And so that's a tender heartedness that he's showing me. In a space that I never have experienced, because there is line upon line, precept on precept, here a little, there a little. I understand now more so about what he did for me to even get me to the space that I would want to be postured like that for other people. That the more I understand what he did for me, the greater I become on how I can do it so easily for others. And so I don't need to be critical, and I can see the goodness in it. And it doesn't mean that it's all or nothing. It's and in both, and it's both, and he sees it all. He sees the law and the love and the grace and the mercy and the justification and all of that. It's all in one. And for me, he's showing Laquita that is a space right now that I'm working with you on. And I'm inviting you there. Come meet me here. And that is just an amazing, because I invite you to believe. Because if I believe that, nobody can ever hurt me again. Because freely I give and freely I receive. I won't take everything so personal. I won't make it about me. I won't see that this was ever intended. Even if it does hurt, it's usually 99.9 and a half not about me. It's about what that other person is going through.
Yeah.
And have they allowed God to go into that space to heal that area, or are they operating from a heart that is still hardened and a space that is still hurting? And it's not about me.
Yep.
And so I'm just so grateful that I'm seeing that, and that I'm experiencing that, and that I'm able to see it from a different perspective. And all I can say to him is thank you for loving me the way you have loved me. And the way you love me, and thank you for waiting on me to get to a space that I am willing to go there with you, that I'm willing to see it from your perspective, Lord, and not my own. Thank you. Just thank you that I now understand when he talks about the church being the bride and him being the bridegroom, that the veil that the bride wears in the natural that covers her face. We look at that as part of the outfit and the beauty of it. But God has been showing me, no, it's part of the process. Because if I unveiled me all at once, you could not sustain it. So the veil that you wear is a gradual lifting for you to see. Mm. And I am now seeing. I'm not easily, he's not totally unveiled me, but I feel like the veil is at least at my eyes and to my mind.
You're getting a little preview.
And that maybe really clear. And that really, that when the veil goes up and the groom and the husband raises the veil to kiss the bride, and you can see the total, and the veil goes back. I feel like that for me, the back, when he's lifting it up right now, and in 32 years of our relationship, you know what I mean? It's like, it's not all the way back. Like, it's not dropped back yet, but it is all the way to the point of my own mind that I can see and feel and think so much clearer, that I can live in the peace that he said, my peace I give you, my peace I leave you, that I can live there and be there as he is unveiling me to his truth.
That's so good. That's a good place to end this. It's such a lot of peace. I feel a lot of peace as you're talking about this. Like, just, you're talking about being tenderhearted, and I, as a witness, I've just watched you transform into like that kind of tenderheartedness. And I don't know, you're just a lot different than when I started working here 5 years ago. So, but anyway, so that's a good place to stop. And until next episode, guys, we will see you.
The year was 1924. A missions worker from Dayton, Ohio, realized that Cincinnati was in need of its own mission. A vision was born after working with business leaders in the area, including James N. Gamble of Procter & Gamble fame. Throughout its 100-year history, City Gospel Mission has worked tirelessly in the community to break the cycle of poverty and despair as a beacon of hope to the homeless, those recovering from life-controlling issues, youth, and those needing job services. City Gospel Mission has also stayed true to being Christ-centered, as the founders intended when they laid the foundation of sharing the gospel of Jesus Christ. We look forward to our next 100 years for changing lives and saving souls. Thanks. You've been listening to the Embracing Change podcast. Music production and mastering by Gone Coastal Productions. Podcast editing and production by Jennifer Osborne. Podcast copyright 2024 by Lakrita Bowman.